You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is an interview recorded live at Bob and Misbehave's bookshop this August as part of the Edinburgh Fringe. It gives me enormous pleasure to bring you an interview with someone I've wanted to get onto the show for a very long time. This is the brilliant Josie Long.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. Hello, thank you so much. Hi.
Thanks for coming. I've just got to apologise for the fact that my stool appears to be hydraulic, so I sat on it and suddenly went lower than you are. But I'll look up to you.
It makes me feel good about myself.
So, listen, I'd normally start by asking how the show is going, but before we start, I would like to point out that on the way here, I remembered when you beat me by half a grape at the Taskmaster in 2012.
Yeah, I think it was 2012. 100% took you down.
You fucking took me down. Will,
you had to see how many grapes you could fit into your mouth.
This is the culmination of a year-long competition.
Yeah, did I win the whole thing?
Yes, you won the whole thing because a grape fell down the back of my throat as I was nonchalantly...
My prize was Tim Key's Perrier Award.
Yeah.
That was my prize. But then on the way out, they were like, oh, you can't keep it.
And yeah. He sort of said, yeah, we had to send in the most valuable thing we owned. That was challenge one in September. Yeah. And then everything would become the prize pot. And Tim sent in his Perrier Award.
Yeah.
And then at the time, he said, if you do win, I mean, I haven't got any nice things. And he sort of made a little sort of defence for it. But did you give it back in the end?
Yeah,
I did. That's all I wanted to know.
But another year, I did mistakenly take a Best Newcomer nominee award. Just kept it. And I've got it on a shelf. I've got a shelf of, like, if I've ever got trophies, I'll put it on the shelf. And I've kept it because it makes me look better than I am, more successful.
So you were nominated for Newcomer, or you won Newcomer?
I did, but then...
award wasn't enough.
But this is a few years afterwards. I was there for getting nominated for another award, and okay. I just took two. Fuck them.
Well, already we're seeing the dark underbelly of Josie Long.
I actually took the wrong one, and then I wrote to them and was like, I didn't take the right one. And then they sent me another one. This is so boring, I'm sorry.
Not at all, my fault. Now, let's start with the show. How's it going?
It's really intense. It's never less intense. Every year I think, oh, this year I'm going to really fucking eliminate all the stress. And like, so I thought it was... Basically, I got here, I did my first three shows, and they were really great fun. I was so excited. And I was like, this is the best Fringe ever. It's literally the best Fringe of my life. And then my fourth show was really shit, and I was like, oh, it's just normal Fringe. It's just normal Fringe. So I think it's just quite a classic Fringe run insofar as I really love performing the shows most of the time, but then maybe one in every four, I feel heartbroken or like there's something wrong or like I can't do it anymore or something.
Because
like
of the show or because of the stress of being at the Edinburgh Festival?
Yeah, I think the stress gets to me sometimes. But I try really hard to mitigate it. Like I work out a lot and you can tell to look at me. I work out a lot and I do a lot of sort of looking after myself and cooking, and I go home early quite a lot. Like I do a really slow run up to the last week, but I think it's going all right. I've sort of loved this. I can't make it sound interesting. I've loved most of it.
No. It's already interesting. And don't freak out that people aren't laughing. There's lots of comics here and go, this is weird. Normally later on than this is happening. But don't panic. We're all... This is exactly what we want.
I have a theory about Edinburgh, which is that I enjoy it more than a lot of my friends do. Mm-hmm. Because I think I, on the whole, enjoy the shows most of the time and find it less stressful, because I like to have this policy, which is where I like don't read reviews, don't look at reviews, don't talk about reviews, avoid people. I have like a little list of people in the back of my head who are like comedians that I think, if I run into you, I will be nice to you, but our conversations will be under 30 seconds.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I have a lot of that. Like, and especially I sort of avoid it when you bump into people and they're like, hey, how's your show? My show's like this. I'm like, I've just been swimming. Goodbye.
Yeah.
I'm more zen than you. So I try really hard to do that. But then I'm such a fucking prick, because then I all say that. And like to all my friends that I share the flat with, I'm like, guys, you know, we're just going to keep the house review free and like just be cool, like, because I've been doing this for like a long time, so you should be cool. And then I fucking, the other day, I looked at the reviews of my show and I found the one review where someone was being a real dick about it, and it got under my skin and I was upset for like 3 days. So nobody is good at the fringe. Nobody is like good at not being affected by it.
Where does this show exist? Where are we in the life of this show? Are you doing Edinburgh before you then take the show on tour?
Yeah, hopefully.
And have you brought it from anywhere else? Did you do it at other festivals on the way here?
No, I did. I sort of, normally when I'm writing my shows, I, in about May, go and do a preview, do a splurge. It's an hour long. And then I tend to just transcribe that and then it'll be done. Like, not be done, but, like, I'll work on it over, like, three months.
What do you mean by do a splurge? Stuff that you never tried anywhere else? Just stuff that you've just written and you turn up and do all of it? Or bits and bobs that you've done in other...
What I do, like, to start writing a show is I'll get an A3 piece of paper and I'll do a spider diagram of all the things that I am interested in, that I think I'd like to write about, bits of material that I've already got that I know sort of I quite like to do, ideas for jokes, sort of any sort of things that preoccupy me. And I make this big chart and then I look at it and I'm like, oh, that's got to be half of it done.
If I can turn this into post-it notes on a wall, I'm there.
And then I go and I do my first preview and I just try and like do it in whatever order feels natural. And then hopefully it feels like it's up and running. And what's been quite odd is every time I've ever done that, it does start at an hour. Like, it always just seems to be an hour. Like, I've never ever done a show where I've underrun or I've underwritten. It's always like worse. It's like, I'm too proud to cut it and it's too long and stuff. But this year, I sort of started doing really tentative warm-ups in January, where I was saying to myself, like, I want this show to develop in, like, a less pressured way. I want it to sort of unfurl. So I would just do the preview, record it, listen to it again, but not try and consciously make any notes about it. Then the next day, do the preview again. So I did three in January where I was trying really hard to sort of take my foot off the pedal and just see what came out. And then I just sort of end up doing one in March, a couple in April, a couple in May, and then basically spending all of June and July properly writing it.
And how has that process differed from... What do you normally do if you're not unfurling? What's the pressure? I mean, this is...
Go on. Oh, sorry, it's my seventh show.
Yeah,
normally what I've done in the past is I do the show, I take it to sort of Soho Theatre or something in the autumn, then in January, February, March, I'll go and tour it in the UK, and then hopefully I'll go to, like, Australia, New Zealand and America or something. And so I tend to finish the show by... I've finished the last show sort of April, May.
Okay.
And so then at May, you have to start the next one.
Okay, so you're not writing, you're not starting writing the next show whilst you're on tour, but you're having the experiences that will probably end up in it.
Yeah, it's not conscious. I find it really, really hard to be writing one thing while doing another. But I do sort of, I keep a journal that's like, my pathetic feelings. And I sort of try and keep abreast of that. And I also like, really do believe in like trying to do lifelong learning and trying to sort of pursue little academic pursuits and really sort of mine what you're passionate about. So while I'm doing that, I do kind of take notes and stuff like that, and hope that at the back of my, I sort of have this very superstitious thing that, like, you're always working, you're always brewing, so you're fine to go swimming in the afternoons and not sit and write, because it's all going on in the back of your head. And then I sort of, in May, we'll start in earnest, like, complete focus on it.
Okay. So let's talk about how you first started. I'm sure this is something you've talked about in lots of interviews before. And I think all I know about your origins as a comic is that you were the youngest person ever to win, which, the BBC?
Oh, yeah.
New Talent. And the beautifully PR-friendly story is that at 17, you were too young to drink the winner's bottle of champagne.
Yeah, still did it.
Yay!
From Orpington. The better thing that happened was on that night, I got really drunk, like absolutely wasted, because they got me a crate of Bacardi Breezes because I was a 17-year-old girl and there were no other 17-year-old girls in the final. So it was just all mine. And I gunned it because I was like, well, I'm not going to win. I'm fucking an idiot. And then Bob Monkhouse is there and he was like, you must sober up because you might have to go back out there. And I was like, whatever. And then he was like, go into my dressing room. And he had this big platter of fruit. And he was like, you must eat all of the fruit. And he was like, stuff myself with fruit. And then, yeah, I won it. I realised that this year I've been doing gigging, proper gigging, like stand-up gigs for half my life.
Yes.
So I started... I actually did my first real gig that was, because there was an art centre near me, and for my 14th birthday, my mum put me on this comedy course, which I'm really amazed that, like, she saw that I would like it. Like, I was obsessed with TV comedy, and I liked showing off and performing at school and stuff, but I would never have thought, oh, I should be a stand-up comedian or anything like that. And then, so from when I was just 14, I started going to this workshop where we would, like, perform for one another, and... Whereas sort of a few other people who work as comedians did go on it.
Who else was there? Because I've only heard very recently of stand-up comedy being taught to young people through places like the Comedy Club for Kids.
Yeah, but it was an adult thing. It was It was me, and then it was like, I shouldn't have been allowed on it. It was 18 plus.
Okay.
And it would be me, and then it would be everyone else would be kind of, there was sort of very odd guys in their 30s who wrote like really laboured puns. And there was a friend of mine who, when I met her, she was 36 and I was 14. And now she's still my friend. And she's sort of looked out for me my whole life and been like a surrogate adult. And the guy who ran the course was 27 and I was 14. And I remember thinking, that guy, he's so old. He's so old. And now I realise he was stoned the whole time. Because he was very laid back and he'd be like, you just need to think about your persona. And then he would go off for a cigarette and come back. And at the time, I was just like, that guy's my... And he's really great. And to be fair, he looked after me as well, because I was sort of a bit... had sort of an odd situation at home where, like, I didn't really sort of go there that much. So I thought it was nice to have, like, surrogate parents and stuff. And I started doing that, did, like, stand up in front of the people at the workshop. And then I did my first real gig when I was 15... And it was at the East Ellis Tavern upstairs. And also, it was new acts and new material.
Okay.
So also
this
on
is
that
the original, the original one. That,
yeah, not the
when it was run by... Yeah, sure. Okay, when it was run by Ron and Emma.
Yeah.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
And, right, on that bill, as well as me, were Joe Brand and Harry Hill. My first gig. And I was just like, oh! And I don't remember any of it. I do remember that the compere was really nice about me afterwards.
Okay.
And I remember that I didn't meet Joe Brand or Harry Hill.
Okay.
And I was a bit like... pissed off that I didn't get to say hi to them. But that as a teenager, I could then go back to school and be like, yeah, I'll give you Joe Brown and Harry Hill. It's not a big deal, which is good. And then I took a break from my GCSEs and then I started again when I was 16 and sort of gigged. Not that regularly, maybe kind of once a fortnight.
Do you remember what the material was? Do you remember your opening line from the first? What was your opener?
I used to go on and I used to really stony faced. I would go, hello, my name is Frank LeBeuf and I play for Chelsea football team. Which I thought was like the funniest thing in the world, because obviously I was a 14-year-old girl and I was like, this is brilliant. And it was never that successful. Because then at the end I'd be like, I thought that would work and it didn't work. But it was always like really silly stuff, like nothing to do with my life.
Okay. And were they jokes that you'd constructed, that you'd written, or was
it
sort
of
silliness?
And
okay.
It was quite surreal. It was quite... deliberately absurdist. So, like, I would do a bit that was like a really long dream sequence bit with like a pullback and reveal punchline at the end that like I was asleep all the time, or like I would I did this bit for ages where I would just come on and do, but bear in mind this is like 16 years ago because I'm sure lots of people have done it since, but I'd be like, my wife, she's so fat, she's in danger of dying, it's so sad, I love her so much, and I just do that for ages but not explain why I was doing it, just do that in that voice for ages and then be like, oh, I like doing a lot of farming. So it would always be like absurd things that I obviously didn't
was
do.
And was that what gave you the confidence to do something so unusual? Was that from the class, or was it the, like an instinct that you had yourself that you, like most people, I think when they start a, you know, their first ever gig, however old they are, they'll think, okay, the opening joke has got to be an opening joke with a feed line and a punchline.
Oh, it was a joke. I was like, it's very funny because I'm not a footballer, but I'm saying I'm a footballer. And I'm a 14-year-old girl. I think I tell you what it was. The things that I grew up really, really loving were Monty Python, Vic and Bob, and like Harry Hill. Mm. So to me, I was like, oh, you can just do whatever you want and just be silly. And I think because the atmosphere was so supportive in the little workshops, and the way he did it was he was like so non-prescriptive. It wasn't like a class. He was just like, think of five things you think are funny and try and do them in a way that conveys it properly.
Okay.
And that was it. And then he'd be like, you've got to find your own voice. And at that time, like, it's funny to look back because I guess I just didn't really have anything to say, or the only thing that was going on in my life that was like big life experience was like situations with my family that were quite difficult. So I couldn't really go on stage and be like, you know, when your stepdad's a real cunt, you're like, ah. You know, so like, and you couldn't be like, you know, when school, you know, school, you know, you couldn't do. And also at the time as well, when I was 17 and I won the BBC, there was a girl who I should say is no longer a comedian who was 17 as well, and she won the Young Comedian of the Year award, and I remember being really fucking pissed off, which is so vain and egotistical even then, that she had a spread in a newspaper that said, I'm Britain's funniest teenager, and I was like, I'm gonna fucking get that girl. She is not, and I didn't like her because her dad wrote all her material, and one of her jokes I can still remember was, oh, well, it's not my fault, I support Aston Villa and they think Tactics is a brand of mint, and I was like, hack. And she went on stage wearing a sparkly hat and braces, and I was like, I think in my head when I was young I was like, I want to be a real comedian, I don't want to be like a novelty children comedian.
Yeah. The first time we gigged together was in Andy Bone's gig in Gypsy Hill.
I remember that.
And you did material about a Japanese toad god.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Netsuke, yeah.
That was Netsuke, Gammon, there we go.
It's Gamasan in with his toad. That's
yes,
what it was.
Yes.
It was because in the British Museum there are like these little things called Netsuke, which are basically key rings that have survived for 1,000 years. And it blew my mind that, like, because I was like, it's like Fido Dido surviving for 1,000 years. It was like, this is what is left of their culture, is the key rings. And then I was reading them all and they were all really interesting. And then one of them just, and they had long descriptions. So they were like, the god of fire who would come down ceremonially once a year. And then one of them just said, Gamasan in with his toad. Like, we'd all be like, oh yeah, Gamasan in with his toad. Of course, with his toad. It makes perfect sense.
I just, at the time, and I was into the kind of the absurdism of Reeves and Mortimer and Harry Hill and that kind of stuff, but when I saw you doing that gig, I was properly like, this isn't like anything else. I don't know that anyone on that night, any of us had a particularly good gig, but I was sort of watching you going, you can do this.
But by that point, I would sort of say that I'd changed what I was doing from, because when I was like 17 to about 20, I did stuff that was just like proper silly all the time. And then after I left uni, I started up again in earnest. And then between 21 and about 23, I sort of tried to move my material to, like, I'd go a lot to galleries and read a lot and just try and do stuff that I thought would be a little bit more out of the ordinary on, like, the open mic scene.
What inspired that choice? Was it just the fact of gigging with open micers and recognising the same tropes?
I think a little bit I wanted to not be hack. It was like a little thing that me and my friends were like, fuck hack comics, we're not like that shit, we want to do experimental stuff. But I think also it was like a hangover from university. Like, I really loved learning to research, and while I was there, for my finals, did a lot of like really going off piste, researching about like weird chat books, which are like old fashioned take a break, and like researching about really obscure kind of literary forgeries and stuff like that. And I just really liked going off and kind of exploring a little thing on my own. And I do really like going to galleries. And I think It's sort of like an aesthetic thing, but it was also just like, that's what I was interested in. I wanted to sort of present things enthusiastically as opposed to just be like, you know, when you're fucking drinking an energy drink and you're fucking, you know, because
I know. I think I speak for us all when we're desperate for you to finish that thought. I'd love to hear you do an observational, a sweary observational routine about energy drinks.
Fucking, you have a panic attack. That happened to me the last time I drank Red Bulls. Is I thought I was going to die and had to go and lie down in the static caravan. Very sad.
When do you think that your persona is the same now as it was when you started out?
No, definitely not. Because I think then it was a persona. It was like, I was very nervous and I would just sort of like be very like, oh, I'm going to do stuff. And now I feel, hopefully, that I'm in a position where I've done it for so long that most of the time when I get on stage, I can be like a sort of exacerbated version of myself. But I try really hard to sort of be really honest and be really open and try and make myself a bit vulnerable. And also just try and like, my dream way of like doing stand-up is to find all my best in-jokes with my friends and ways that I muck about and use the sort of comic tropes that I have in my life and then bring them to stage a bit. And then also kind of now I think luckily the last sort of, well, I would say ever since I've done solo shows, but definitely in the last like 4 years, I've been able to write about things that I really feel passionate about that maybe have some edge to them. So write a little bit more where I'm like, no, that is wrong and that is a bad thing and I'm angry about that, as opposed to just like when I was young, it was just like silly, silly, silly. And then when I was 24 and I did my first solo show, I tried really hard to write only about positive things. I wanted to do a show that was quite like deliberately, pointedly, aggressively not cynical, whereas I think now I've got a little bit more light and shade.
It's Josie Long, everyone. She's an incredible comic, a gifted joke writer. She's also an absolute ray of sunshine. The last 5 minutes of this interview have inspired me to maybe make a collection of all the inspiring bits of all the episodes so far and set them to music, maybe as like an emergency episode to be used after bad gigs. In case of emergency, break glass, listen to MP3, something like that. She is relentless in the best possible way. Absolutely delightful to talk to. I hope you enjoy listening to this as much as I did recording it. So, just a couple of things and we'll get straight back in. Last call about the next live ComCom special with the fabulous Tom Stayed. I was about to say brilliant and I realised I've overused brilliant recently. With the fabulous Tom Stayed. Absolutely superb comedian. Lives in Edinburgh and travels all over the country, all over the world. We're doing him in Wolverhampton. This coming Monday, the 22nd of September. So get yourself there. The Arena Theatre, Wolverhampton. Details are on their website and also up at ComCom Pod on Twitter and in the Facebook page. Tickets are only £5. See you there. Just a couple of thanks to some people who've donated recently. I thought it'd be nice. There is a space for you to leave a little message when you donate, and some people use that. So I just thought I'd read out a few of those. Luke Finley says, thanks for the podcast. I'm not a comic, but I'm interested in the mechanics of comedy. I'm donating £1 for everyone I've listened to. And then he adds rather ominously, ... for now. Thank you, Luke. Much appreciated. Roger Clark sent me £3 and says, bish, that's for Nick Doody. That's the kind of immediate transaction that as a former street performer I quite enjoy. A friend of mine once said, a street performing buddy of mine called Conrad Riverland, lovely guy, he said that the ultimate logical extension of street performing would be to go into a shop, do a handstand and be given a tin of beans. So £3, bish, that's for Nick Doody. That's very kind of you and much in keeping with my the way in which I see the world. Thank you, Roger. I lost your other email. I know you've donated before, but many thanks for those donations. Alison Turner says, here's £10 for all the brilliant episodes I've listened to and the extra £2. Good work, Alison. And I got a very generous donation from David McCluskey, who says, thanks for the 90 episodes. I met you at the Pleasance this year and said how much I was enjoying the podcast, but I think that Phil Jupitus and Bridget Christie are perhaps two of the best. Thank you very much, David. I'm very proud of those episodes. So thanks to all of you. Really appreciate the love you're showing for the show, whether it's £2 or £20 or £1 a show. It's all going to be very useful in a very tangible way quite soon. I'll say no more for now. I referred to this loosely last week, but I've got some pretty big plans on the horizon and your continuing support is very, very useful. Remember, of course, if you don't want to donate, you can support the show by telling someone new about it. Tweet me at ComComPod, email me info@comedianscomedian.com, and let's get back to the wonderful Josie Long.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think, given that you were so young, given that you were discovering who you were as a person, as a teenager, and then someone in their early 20s, do you think there was kind of an interplay between who you were on stage? I suppose what I'm asking is, if you're discovering who you are on stage, is that happening at the same time as you discover who you are as a person?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I do feel really weird. I feel like one of those, I've said it before, I think, but I feel like one of those people who are like, they get married at 16 and then when they're 50, they're like, I can't leave, he owns the house, you know? And that's how I feel with stand-up. Like, it's just so much a part of everything to me. Like, I love it and I don't see it as separate from me. I see it as like, without it, I'm not me. I just feel like it has been the way that I've processed the world, processed my life, thought about things. It like gives me something, like it balances me out and it makes me feel more sane and less annoying at parties because I've got an outlet. It just sort of, I feel like I have grown up with it, and it's how I, like, I keep my feelings journal for myself, but then I just pillage it for my shows. Like, there's very little distinction between kind of what I've done and what, like, I feel like with my stand-up I'm creating this little body of work that belongs to just me, that I'm proud of, that I sort of reassure myself that I'm alive and that it's all right and that I've done something with my life. And it helps me make sense of the world and definitely helped me grow up, I think.
And what are the other things? When you say you had a show in 2004 that was aggressively uncynical, are there other kind of like that's almost like a meta job of the show? Like, the first job is you've got to make people laugh, people got to buy tickets, all the rest of it. And then there's kind of other layers of intention behind it.
Yeah.
So what are some of the other intentions of
shows that I've done?
Yeah.
Well, the first show and the first few shows I did, I liked having an art project alongside the show. Mm-hmm. So the first show I did, I got everyone to tell me a small good thing that they liked, and I collected them all and I sort of put them on the walls and I made a fanzine out of it. And then the second one, I gave out these postcards that were blank postcards, and then people had to find an eccentric person they really admired and then draw them and send them back to me. So I had like this big archive of the postcards. And then the third show I did had a museum where I wanted people to give me items that they'd found or something. I can't remember anymore. That's bad.
But apart from
the Museum of Lost Items, I think.
Apart from the, obviously, those are kind of format, the projects. Structures of the show, art projects. But what was, like, why? Why was it that you wanted to receive stuff from other people? Because you've always been really creative and you've always given things away. I've still got one of your badges that says 6 out of 10.
Oh, my God, yeah. That's really old.
Yeah, so a long time ago.
I used to spend hours making badges by hand for my shows to give out to people, which is full on.
Yeah.
It was in the voodoo room. Oh, I tell you, so I know what you mean. Like, I think, basically, I do tend to sort of have a thing that I'm trying to convey to people on the whole. And what I like, and one of the reasons I wanted to start doing tours just straight after having done my first show, was because I like the idea of linking up with creative people around the country and like collaborating a little bit and just finding people. Like, I was really like, I want to find the people in Leeds and Leicester who also like what I like and like comic books or like want to do zines or stuff like that. So there's an element of trying to coax people out into sort of sharing things with me creatively and finding out stuff like that. And that's been part of it. And also, so the first show was kind of about celebrating DIY culture that I really love, kind of this idea of like, make your own club, set your own thing up, do your own thing. And so I wanted to kind of see if I could like zhuzh anyone into doing that or find other people who like that. And then, so I think a lot of my motivation is to find like-minded people and then have fun times. And then the second show I did was about eccentricity and about kind of being unabashed about that. And so I wanted to kind of put that out there. And the third show I did was about lifelong learning and about wanting to sort of inspire like a broad Renaissance-style creativity. And then with the three shows that I did, I did three shows that were about politics. And with those, genuinely, what I secretly wanted to do was like stoke up people who were better people than me into doing more political activism and like murdering the government, which still hasn't happened, which is a shame, but
But that's a really interesting kind of like, if you're sort of thinking, well, maybe I myself wouldn't be a great politician, but if I can deliberately inspire someone that would be, that would make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's like a really rational kind of, it's almost like a MacGyver approach to politics.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to use what I've got. And in your case, what you've got is lots and lots of people who follow you creatively and want to join in with things.
Yeah.
And you go, hey, why don't we all join in with Burning
Brainwash
Down?
Brainwash them.
Yeah.
But I do talk about like how it's like making sleeper cells of socialists who are like ready to... But But it was more for me as well with the politics stuff. I did honestly feel like when I first started talking about it, I just felt this responsibility, like this weird thing that was like, if I don't talk about this, I won't be able to look myself in the eye later on. I'll feel like I let myself down by not speaking out against something. I don't know. It just felt like this really intense urge. And then the second year I did it, I really just wanted to find people who felt how I felt, who felt really beaten down and felt really despairing and freaked out and hated what the coalition are doing, and just say to them, like, you're not alone and you're not mad and you're right, and the vast majority of, like, the media is against you and you'll constantly come up against people trying to pick you apart and shout you down, but I want this to be supportive for you. And, like, got people being like, oh, it's put you into the choir. And I was like, yes, because they need it. Like, they need someone to be like, you're not alone, it's going to be all right. I didn't really care about converting people at that stage. And then the last show, I just wanted to get girls. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. It was like the obvious thing to say. The last show, this show, I don't know. I thought I wanted to write something personal because I realised that I'd never tried to write a show about love or about how I felt. And I weirdly just really wanted to talk about things with my family and my sister, and I've ended up not saying as much as I thought I was going to, but I just think I wanted to, just to sort of help me get over it finally. Like, I think when things are a bit tricky in your childhood, like, you spend a lot of time working it through, and I don't know, I thought it could be an act of, like, drawing a line and starting afresh or something.
I think it's definitely, I mean, I found it your most enjoyable show, and I've enjoyed all of them.
Really?
But yeah, thank you. Absolutely. Because I think part of what really... what I really love about it is that I think it's a more mature you. I think there's loads of you laughing at yourself. And like when you're talking about, you know, oh, what I like doing is a load of sub-Amelie shit. Do you know what I mean? That kind of... that. Yeah.
It's fair.
These are your words. They're your words. I feel like I'm accusing you of that. But I think you obviously got tagged with the whimsy, like being the queen of whimsy, the person that started or...
That blows my mind, that, because like... what I see it as is people who didn't see your show need to sum you up in about 5 words.
Sure,
so they pick a word, true, yeah. And then people who didn't even see that and then decide it. But I
But you did. I think you spearheaded, whether intentionally or not, a lot of people doing graphs.
Yeah, maybe, but I didn't mean to.
No, I know you were
making
badges.
Because I fucking started, but I was doing it on my own steam. I think there was like,
and I'm not, and I don't mean at all. If there's anyone listening to this who has done
graphs,
I like graphs as well. And I think it's more to do. It's less to do with people copying you than people going, oh, I can actually do. I can pursue
anything I want.
Yeah, I can do anything I want. Whatever I think is funny is fine.
That's what I love about the Fringe. Is every time I approach it, I think the room is mine. I can do literally anything with it if I want to have an. To be fair, all I'm doing is just chatting this time. But like, if I want to put up posters, if I want to completely change the setup, if I want to hide things, if I want to, you know, invite people in as they're coming in, if I want to stand in the crowd, I can really rethink. It doesn't just have to be one person getting up, doing an hour of stuff and leaving. It can be anything in there. And I like that sort of theatricalness. But I also think, I saw it as like there was a little movement of us, or there was a big group of us that I was really proud of, who were like all quite DIY.
Yeah.
Like we ran a lot of gigs and we would try and put on strange events and we would sort of... just try and see how we could do things our own way. And like when I first started touring, I really felt that, because it was just basically me and my old manager like trying to hustle, like setting up like new gigs at new weird venues and like just trying to kind of do things a different way. And like Robin Ince especially, like 10 years ago, I feel like there was a lot of people who had to work really hard to kind of just create a bit of space for there to be weirder stuff and more sensitive stuff or whatever. And I felt like I was past that part of that. And it's funny, because whimsical in itself is not a derogatory term, but I think a lot of people who maybe never really got what I was doing or just hated me and thought I was shit, wanted to, like, whimsy, it rhymes with flimsy. It makes it seem like what you're doing is insubstantial and shit and not proper jokes. And it's always upset me, like, if I've ever used to get reviews that were like, it's nice, it's not funny, it's nice. And I'd be like, fuck you, to my mind, this is, like, the funniest possible thing in the world. So it's nice for me to sort of feel like, at least I'm getting practiced in doing this.
Yeah.
So then even people who hate me have to be like I got a review the other year of this guy who for 10 years has always thought I was shit. And he gave me like the best review he's ever given me, which was basically, I still don't like it, but you've got to admit she's been doing it a long time. And it was like, yeah, cunt. I'm going to keep doing it. And I think with a lot of things like that, like, just staying in the game is so useful. Like, just putting in hours and hours of stage time, you just get better at being who you are and stronger at being who you are. And, like...
Do you find, given that you went, like... I think from the outside, it's probably easy to go, oh, you know, incredibly talented, charmed life, one competition.
Charmed
you,
life.
No. I think, yeah, no, I, well, this is what I want
is
to talk about.
Who would think about me? That's hilarious.
I think you're so good at what you do, and what you do has been so embraced by your audience. You're obviously very, very successful for someone of your age. I mean, you've been going a long time, admittedly, but I wonder whether you feel like that. Obviously not. But like, I think from the outside, do you see what I mean? Do you see how someone could go, anything she touches is interesting and loved and warmly embraced by people?
That doesn't feel like that at all. Like, I've had, like, God, that's crazy. Like, also, like, I'm not, like, a big comedian. Like, I can't buy a house. Not that that's important, but, like, I don't earn a lot of money. I'm not, like... Like, to me, like, successful people are people who are, like, always on TV with their own show. Not that I even think I don't know if I would want that anyway, but, like, so this is why it's obviously not the case. But, like, I would not see myself like that. Like, I think I've sort of been doing my own little thing, and I've been very, very lucky insofar as, because we started touring early, and I feel like that was sort of, like, quite an audacious thing to do. But because we did that, and the first tour I did was actually quite difficult, and the second one wasn't that easy, but now I've done six, I do feel really lucky in a position where I just do my shows and I love it, and I have loads of people who come, like, and I look like I really treasure that, you know, and I don't have to do gigs that I don't want to do, and I never ever say yes to things that I don't think would be sort of in keeping with my personal brand. but, like, I don't want to sort of compromise my integrity or anything like that, or what I see as my integrity. And, like, but I feel like it's never been, like, a free ride. Like, there's always been loads of, like, critics who thought I was shit, or, like, I sort of feel like I'm not a proper comedian because I don't do proper comedian clubs and I never can.
Do you feel like that?
Yeah,
I was talking to John Kearns last night in the bar, and I was having just seen his show, his second show, equally brilliant as the first one. Absolutely love it. And he was saying that about me. He was like, well, you're proper. You know, I'd love to be able to be that thing where you turn up and you're everyone's mate and you do jokes and stuff. And I was going, are you mental? Do you know what I mean? Because I think everyone on whichever side of that spectrum that they're on, well, I don't know. I mean, does everyone covet the other thing? Do you want to be able to do, like, to sort of... you know, fight your way through hen nights at a weekend gig?
To be fair, no, I absolutely do not. I love what I do. And I don't feel like I'd like to be doing anything differently to how I do. That's not true. But I don't know. Like, I had this really weird time after my first show. I feel a little bit like, in some ways, I've got some sort of weird frontier stuff.
Yes,
because I was a little bit precocious compared to a lot of my peers because I started younger. There's a lot of things that I sort of encountered all on my own, like, weirdly. And so, like, after my first show, I was so innocent with it, and it makes me sad because, like, I was so thrilled just to be doing a show. Like, finally, it was the happiest month, really. It was the happiest Fringe I've ever had because I was just so happy to have an hour to myself, have the ring to myself, set up my art projects, like, and I got good reviews and I was reading them and I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it, it's amazing. And then I did a show for ITV2 where all the nominees for Best Newcomer were interviewed. And I did an interview, which I thought was perfectly acceptable. I was like, they asked me something and I said, in a voice, I sort of went, well, you know, I quite like it, but I'm not like, you know, do you know what I mean? Right, and they cut that and they put that in the show. And then, like, there's this comedy forum that went, like, ballistic in its hatred of me. Like, crazy in how much it hated me. And it would put, like, videos on YouTube to slag me off. And, like, it just was, like, super intense trolling of me. Like, it was
in a time kind of when trolling was first
coming
into existence.
Yeah. I was really
well used. I think, but that's it, like, you people now, I think, are used to the idea that the internet is full of pricks and they can attack you.
Yeah,
but you
or at the very least,
weren't
I feel
so
like there's lots
that.
Of women around and everyone says it in the open and you go, yeah, that's unacceptable. And the people who'd been really fucking creepy about me were the ones who were the Mary Beard ones who were unmasked. And I remember there was a newspaper article this year where I saw a photo of one of these people who'd been so disgusting to me for years. And it was so weird to see him and be like, ha, you live in Sidcup and you're an estate agent. But that was a thing that I sort of... if anyone would be like, oh, she had a charmed life, like, I would think about that, because that, like, for about a year and a half, it, like, knocked me off my course, because I just, whenever I went on stage, I'd be thinking, oh yeah, which one person here is going to take this to put on a comedy forum so everyone can slag me off, like, who here is going to say they're going to, like, rape me or fucking kill me or whatever, you know, stuff like that. And so it was like such a weird experience, and because I didn't know anyone else, it was like pre-Twitter, I guess, Twitter's like changing my life, but before Twitter, I just sort of told a couple of my friends, but I just knew it was there, and every now and again sort of someone would send me a link to it and I'd be like, oh, there's more of it, and like, it was sort of a weird thing to like have. I don't know why. That's quite self-pitying, me being like, oh,
Jesus, no, it isn't.
Easy. I'll tell you this.
But, not at all. Not at all. I'm constantly staggered. I think I've mentioned this on the show before, that almost all of the female comics I know on Facebook have a secret identity name,
yeah,
so that you can't be Googled, whereas none of the male comics I know the need to do that.
And that is a really weird, entrenched, privileged thing, that all my male peers are great and none of them are arrogant about it or weird about it, but all my female friends who are comedians, we all know what it's like to get reviewers who they're middle-aged men and they're deliberately, or maybe not even deliberately, they just don't get what you do because their life is so different to yours. Mm. And to get people kind of discussing your appearance in like really grim, grotesque ways, to get people sort of threatening to rape you, threatening to kill you. Like, we've all had that shit over and over again. And like, it's such a weird thing. And then on top of that, obviously, since I was 16, I've had people questioning whether or not I'm allowed to do my job because I'm a woman, telling me that I'm not good at my job inadvertently because I'm a woman, like not booking me, you know, stuff like that. So it's been a weird old thing to sort of come through. And now I think it is changed a little bit. And I think a few of us like feel better about it.
You feel what, the abuse isn't there anymore, or that your attitude to it has changed such that, I mean, you're talking about it incredibly frankly and sort of happily. You seem very kind of emotionally bulletproof about these awful things. I mean, I can't imagine anyone else going, oh, they threatened to rape me and kill me. And you sort of, you seem like you're totally over it.
Yeah, I am, definitely, because I had it, because I felt sad about it for a while, for years, yeah. But I just sort of reached this point. It was quite nice, really, like to think, like, I sort of realised something about reviews and something about them, which was, I'm still doing what I love, and it's not changed a thing, and it's not stopped me. And then I was like, ha, nothing's going to stop me, ever. Like that, and that was like, ah, fuck those cunts. Like, and I do feel a bit like glad to have got through it, because I feel like, oh, like nothing could hurt me now, like really. Except, well, it will still hurt you, but like nothing will like disable you as a performer. I don't know. Yeah, I would definitely say I'm over that, which is quite nice. And now I have such a fun time with, if people are abusive to me, I like enjoy thinking of new ways to try and troll them a bit. Like, so just like, my favourite thing is just writing unsubscribe, because then they get really annoyed because they're like, no, this isn't a list. And I'm like, yeah. And then also insinuating that they find me sexually attractive, they hate anything. But yeah, it's a funny old thing. And it was what was so weird was, like, my first show genuinely was about like, you should try and see the small positives in life, and like, life is worth doing, and try setting up your own things. And then to get like the amount of abuse I got from it, who were like, this cunt should be raped and killed. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh, guys, I think you're focusing in the wrong places here. Like, I'm a 24-year-old woman performing to between 11 and 45 people a night. Like, and then, yeah, so it's kind of funny.
Let's talk about the writing. Of the material. Do you feel that you've got, like, I mean, I know you sort of say when you come to write a show, and do you write specifically for shows now? If you don't need to write for 20s, or I mean, anything you write gets turned into a show, and ideally turned into a tour.
To be honest, I've never written a proper club 20 since 2005 was the last time I wrote a club 20.
And do you feel that you have like a sort of toolkit of things you'll do to an idea to try and find the funny in it?
Yeah, I guess so, actually. I do a lot of, like, bashing ideas about, where I'll, like, take a thing and I'll, like, try and spider diagram off it and see all the different, pardon me, things that I think of when I'm thinking about that thing. But it's more that, like, what I like to do is I like to write via previews. So I'll have a thing that I know I want to say, or, like, an idea, like, I know I want to use, and then I'll just try and improvise something. And if that fucks up, try something else and each new time and stuff like that.
Okay.
Do I have like a way of writing stuff? Beyond just like thinking around it, it's more like knowing the sort of thing that I want to write about and then giving it a go these days, I think. I don't know.
Okay.
I feel like my brain's gone blank and that I'm not sure whether I know.
Well, when you, like, just to, like, for example, not even like a joke, but like, just to take an example, something that really made me laugh in your show, one of the many things, was that you described, I think it was possibly your stepdad and mum or some adults in your life having a relationship based on intrigue.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like a euphemism.
Generously
for...
describe as full of intrigue.
Yeah, absolutely. So something like that, is that just something that you'd say to a mate and you thought, oh, that's funny?
Oh,
or
I
is
see
that,
what you
is
mean.
That, is that written out? Is it kind of, you know?
That was a case of, well, I do steal in jokes that I have with my friends and family a lot. Like, I like to play games a lot, and then I do like to just steal them and use them in the show, definitely. And I do also kind of come up with, like, I'll have an idea for a bit, and I'll try and, like, really bash that around. So, like, I've got this bit in my show where I talk about how the ghost of an old relationship sits on your shoulder, and then when you forget about it, it comes out, and it's like, you had it, but you squandered it. And I thought that, I just thought of that one line of, like, this thing going, you had it, but you squandered it. And so then I tried to, like, write a little play script version of that. But with that line, it was basically, I knew that I wanted to say a few really serious things, and I knew I'd have to try and gag it up a little bit. So I just would, like, force myself in previews to be like, just say something that's sort of a joke about this.
And, okay.
Like, that came from writing shows about politics where I knew that there were serious things I wanted to say, but I knew if I wrote one or two serious lines, I would have to undercut it immediately to try and keep it flowing as a comedy show. So then I would sort of... So it was the same with that, really. It was like, right, I need to try and find a way to make me saying this funny, but still convey the information that I want.
And do you? And is there... When you talk about the politics stuff, when you're writing political material, what's the... I mean, obviously, the starting points are your anger at a particular thing.
Yeah.
So then... What happens next in that? If you come in and you go, I'm annoyed about the coalition, they've done a particular thing has sort of got under your skin. What's the next step in terms of, like, trying to make that palatable to an audience that won't be bashing them over the head with...
I've got a few techniques, right? One of them is that I always tend to try and make it a personal narrative so that I'm not preaching, but I'm just explaining how I felt at different particular points because of different things I found out or experienced. So I try and, like, make it about... the fact that I felt really weakened and depressed because that has happened, or I felt really thrilled and wonderful because we did this protest, but then this, that, the other happened. So I try quite hard to structure a narrative of what's happening in the hope that people will sort of identify with it as opposed to feeling a bit, like, badgered. But then sometimes there'll be things that I just desperately want to say on stage, like in my show this year, I really want people to know that the new Olympic Park is not a public space. It's owned by the Qatari royal family. And so, like, I was like, I need to get that in. So what I'll do is I'll get it in as part of a fantasy sequence where I can say it in a voice where I'm being a bit of a nerd, like, I think you should find that this.
Yes, okay.
And then it sort of couches it, but I still get the information out there.
Yes.
And then also I like distractionary techniques. So in 2011, I wrote a show that was about politics, but... I'd never really written a whole show about politics before, so a lot of the time what I would do is I'd go, I don't want to be doing this. I have to tell you that the coalition are closing libraries because it's bullshit. I would rather be talking about and then do 5 minutes about me swimming in the sea or something.
Okay,
so that
yeah.
you're, like, dragging people back. And quite often I do have a lot of, like, things that I don't mean to do, and I guess they're, like, tics, but, like, silly voices or deliberately undercutting what I'm saying. So, like, being, like, you know, like, I'd say something... about, like, politics and then be like, am I right, ladies? You know, like, for no reason. Or, like, or be like, you know, the most important things is that we fight really hard and we don't take shit. And then I'd be like, and that's my motto for dancing. Or do you know what I mean? Like, deliberately do something to sort of take you away and, like, lighten
yes.
it.
Where is that from? Where does that originate from? Is that you just discovering that when you're doing gigs where you're doing heavier-handed stuff a few years ago, heavy-handed political stuff, and you're going... I mean, were you doing difficult gigs where you're going, I'm saying everything I want, but they're not laughing? Or did that always bubble underneath it?
It's sort of a couple of things. My first time doing shows, when I first started writing, I did, like, acting out little plays in it. Like, I really like doing silly things, like I've done, like... a thing where, like, I imagine myself in a certain place and then I'm like, and then I said to them this and they said this, and I like doing characters and acting little bits. So there's always been a sort of thread that was quite theatrical in what I like to do. But on top of that, it was definitely the case that, especially in 2011 when I was doing this show, that I just fucking care about it so much and I felt so passionate and sad about it that there were loads of things that in previews sometimes it was just so aggro. And I remember one of my friend's brothers coming and him just being really put off by it because I was really like, and the other thing with the... And so it was just kind of a gradual learning process of like, if you're going to do that, you have to undermine yourself and you have to undercut it. And one of my friends said something like that because he came to see it and he's just not really that politically minded. And he said, what you need to do is every time you set something up, you need to fuck with it. You can't, because people will still know that you're earnest about it, but yeah, they won't come out feeling like they've been beaten up. They'll come out sort of feeling like, oh, that was lots of silly stuff. And I think, so then, yeah, it was just previewing, knowing that quite often when I'm doing like warm-up gigs, I just know there are bits that aren't funny enough. And this little desperate improvisational part of my brain will be like, add a punchline, do something, do anything. And sure, so that's what I do.
In the editing process, could you give us an example of something that you have dropped from the show and why?
Oh, what have I dropped? A lot of it is like bits that I thought were a good end to bits. Can I think of anything really big that I've dropped? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. At the start of the show, I was going to do 5 minutes about, this is true, I had a dream that I did a show in front of loads of people where I showed a chart that showed how unequal the wealth distribution in the United Kingdom was. And in the dream, everyone was fucking outraged and then they all sorted it out. and then I genuinely woke up and I was like, a prophecy. And so I had a few bits and bobs about trying to sort of, I had a bit about how to get people to feel powerful about politics is you all have to imagine that there's an imaginary revolution. Mm. You have to imagine, you know, the date of the upcoming revolution. So like now it'd be like September 30th or whatever. And you have that in the back of your mind. And so whenever you're talking to someone who's trying to put your opinions down, or whenever you're watching like really Tory biased media, you can be like, well, we'll see how they do on the 30th of September. And both of those things were to sort of try and like judge people along a bit, but it just sort of transpired that the more I did the show, the more I was like, it's not relevant for me to do 5 minutes at the beginning about, because I thought I was going to start the show, do 5 minutes about politics that was like the cleverest, best, well-researched thing I'd ever written, where I like took to task wealth inequality in the UK, and I was like, in my head I thought it would be like a spoken word rap thing where I was like, and another thing on the Duke of Cornwall, what a cunt, blah, 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 and then like throw the mic down and then be like, now my show. And then I just sort of realised that like, you don't need to prove anything like that. Like if I want to write a show where I literally just come on and go, I got my heart broken, I don't want to talk about it, I can just do that. Like, it's not my concern if people are like expecting a certain thing from me. Like, it's a delight if people expect something from me, I suppose. But like, I should just do what it is and not. So I sort of got rid of all, well, not all of it. I'd like to think there's a political thread in it, but I got rid of all the things that were ostensibly just like, this is politics and not relevant. And it's kind of a thrill to do it, actually, to cut it away and go, no, this show isn't about politics. And also because me and my friend set up a charity, so I feel like on a daily basis I'm doing something useful. So I don't feel like I need to prove that I'm political necessarily to people. Like, I don't mind. I don't think, I don't know. I sort of feel like for 3 years I was like, I'm a socialist. And so now I'm like, I also enjoy outdoor pursuits.
I wanted to talk about the development of your audience over the last 7 shows, because you are someone I think of as having a real following. Like, people know what they really want to know what you're going to do next.
And that's my dream. I would absolutely love that.
Well, I think that's part of what they respond to, at least, is you're so kind of like, I've made you a thing. I'm just constantly giving you not just physical objects, you know, stories and stuff. It's for you and I'm putting it out there. And do you think that is, you know, do you feel that you have kind of mustered your own gang? And if so, how did you do that? And why do you think they're so up for it?
I sort of think yes and no, because it's funny, right? The first few shows I wrote, it felt really easy to be like, these people have all come to the show. And it felt really coherent in my head. I was like, I'm doing this. And then by the time I got to this show, I'm like, oh, I'm like a band that's released 10 albums. And so it's like most bands, you'd be like, oh, I really like that one. I can't be fun. I'll wait a few years. I'll get the next one. You know, like, okay, if you sort of keep producing that much.
That's quite shrewd to have that eye on the possibility of that not, you know, the possibility of that happening.
Yeah, I think people will dip in and out, because you can't spend 10 years of your life being like, I must go every year to see that person. But there's a very small, small group of people who have seen every single one of my shows. And oh my God, they get smaller by the year as well, because I kill them. But it makes me very happy. The way that I started with my first Edinburgh show was because I was in a venue that was run by my old manager, and he's quite kind of, he's quite a wide boy, really. And I think he would take that kindly as well. But like, he was like, well, you can give us as many tickets as you want. We just want to get the right people in, get word of mouth, right? So the first week of this show, I just went around and I looked at who looked cool. And then I got to like cool young dudes and be like, excuse me, would you come to my show? And then I was quite lucky because it would often be like young comedians that I would like the look of and be like, please come. And then they sort of came in. I feel like, I think it was very lucky, as I say, to start touring really quickly. And I think I did get a few little bits and bobs of like TV exposure every now and again. And so because it seemed to have quite a distinct aesthetic, and because I was always quite open about like, I like these films, I like these books, I like this stuff, I think it did mean that people who shared interests with me could find me and stuff. And I do think because I was quite relentless with touring, like every year touring, it did mean that people could know to come back and it could build a little bit. I think the way I've built my crowd... I don't know. I mean, I don't know how consistent or real it is either. Like, I wouldn't say that I'd ever feel like I'm in a position where, like, I'm like, I'm safe, mate, or anything like that. Like, it's, you know, it's not many people we're talking about. Like, especially, for example, in Hay on Wye, where it's 10 people. 10 people in Hay on Wye. And if it's a 9-hour round trip, there's 10 people. And they didn't even give us a meal at the venue. That was the worst part. I don't know. I think maybe just because I'm quite open about the books and the music that I love, so then that is a sort of community of people to share with. And I do quite a lot of crossovery things with music. Like, I've got a lot of friends who are in bands and do gigs with them and stuff, and like done music festivals and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's been a bit funny. I tell you what was funny, doing politics stuff. I definitely felt like there were a contingent of people I lost and a contingent of people I gained.
Okay.
And that was very interesting.
Yeah.
And also it's sort of like not wanting to lose people's respect as
well. Did that hurt, though, to feel like, you know, people who were interested in what you had to say, when you changed what you were saying, they went, oh, maybe we're not so interested anymore?
Well, it did and it didn't, but you can't please everyone consistently year on year. That's a thing that I have to, like, always tell myself, is, like, you just don't know what someone's going to prefer that you did. Like, if I think about it, like, there's a musician that I really love called Bill Callahan. I think he's amazing. He's made, like, I probably have 7 favourite Smog albums that he's made. And recently he's made a couple of albums that I've just not been feeling in the same way. But it doesn't mean that I don't love him. I just will keep buying what he buys.
Sure.
And eventually it'll be all right, hopefully. And so I just sort of feel like you just can't tell who's going to like what bit. And I just have to... I can only do what I think is the best possible thing that feels genuine and honest and real. Because I'm also quite... shit with my attention span. Like, I like to do what I'm, I like to be involved with my thing and do it, and then I get bored of it and I want to do a new thing. So I just can't try and pander, because, and that was the other thing, like, with being a proper comic, I've never felt like, somebody said to me, like, oh, there's two types of comedians. There's comedians that work out what the audience wants and do that, and then there's comedians that work out what they want and do that. And I've always been the second type, because I just don't know what the crowd want, and when I try and do what they want, it never works. So I have to do what I want. And so that's the only way to sort of try and keep it. So it is funny, but I sort of think, fuck it, people drop away. Like, this is what I thought of politics. I thought, people have said that I should be murdered for doing stuff about how much I hate it when I kill snails accidentally on the pavement. So I might as well say that David Cameron should be murdered, because I've already got... maybe that's a bad... That's a really clumsy way. But I might as well come out and say, I'm a socialist and I'm not crazy for thinking that, and it's not weird to be left-wing, it's normal to be left-wing, I'm not some crazy hippie. I might as well come out and say that. Because I've already
they're not
going
to hate you anymore, are they? Yeah.
People hate me for existing, so I might as well... So I don't really feel frightened by that. But what was funny is a friend of mine, who's another comedian, my friend John Nick Roberts, said to me this week, he was like, oh, I'm glad you're not doing politics anymore, because my family can come and see it again. And I was like, cool, I guess. But I just think it's funny, like, because people try and pigeonhole you anyway. So then when I did politics, I thought that people would be like, oh, she's not whimsical anymore, she's political. And now they're like, oh, she's not political anymore. And it's just like, I'm just a person trying to do some stuff. Like, the common factor in all of it is you anyway. So you just have to hope. Is that too... Sorry.
It's not too anything. No, that's great. Do we have any questions? We must wrap up fairly soon, but we've got time for one or two. Do you have any guidance for moving from the more silly stuff into the more personal stuff?
Well, like, firstly, don't forget that you're allowed to be silly with it. Like, you can take that lightness into anything. So you can still play around, you can still imagine things. Like, I was thinking about a question you asked before, like, with writing and how do I bash about an idea. Like, I like to sort of really just ask as many questions as I can with it. Like, where would it go? What would it do? In the future, what would it be? How would I do it? And, like, really sort of try and conceptualise as much as possible. And so if you're trying to think about, say you're writing about an experience you've had that was, like, a bad experience at school or something, you can still kind of treat it in a whimsical way, like in a fun, inventive way, and kind of move your routine through that. Like, there's a really brilliant... I was talking to my boyfriend about this yesterday. I've got a boyfriend, bad luck. There's a Dave Chappelle routine, about what does it mean to be 15? And about how... And it's like one of my favourite routines in the world, because it starts out, I think, very silly. And it's about a kidnapped girl, but it's also about a murdered little boy. And because the kidnapped girl is white and the murdered little boy is black, the 15 thing is treated like she's like this little Disney princess and he's like this criminal, you know. And the way he does that routine is like, starts out political satire. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it basically goes, starts out really silly, goes crazy inventive silly, then suddenly is really really serious political satire, and then is like heartbreaking, makes a very important point with it, and all of that is in the one routine. And I think it's like really important to remember that, like, you can take it anywhere you want, and if you really feel what you're saying, if you really care about what you're saying, you just keep that as a through line and you're all right, I think. And also, like, you can get away with mad tangents and then just literally coming back and, like, just going, so as I was saying this, people are like, oh, cool, we're back, all right, you know. Like, you can do all kinds of distractionary things as long as you feel like you've properly got the thread of it and the heart of it down, you can sort of do it.
I'd like to finish then. This is a classic wrap-up question. What would be your final message to comedy? If you had to leave one message behind.
I'd be like, thanks for having me. You've been the best friend in the world. I appreciate the fact that you've meant that I haven't had to get up and do shit boring things. And I also have enjoyed the travel and the free food. I think I would, like, genuinely, like, I love being a comedian. I see it as like a lifelong vocation, and I'm thrilled about that. I'm thrilled that there were, you know, there are old lady comedians, and that you can be, and I'm thrilled that you can just be you and change it and be so skittish with it and, like, do whatever you want. Like, I honestly, what I think of with comedy is that I feel privileged to be part of the community, and I hope other comedians listen to this don't think I'm a dickhead, because, like, that's bad. But, like, I love being a part of it. Like, with Edinburgh, I love coming up and being like, I'm one of the comedians, you know. So I suppose I'd be like, thanks, comedy. Despite all of the cruelty you've given me and the insulin resistance, I still appreciate it.
Given that you are, and this was, that should have been the last question, but it's just brought something up in my mind. Given that you are probably one of the least cynical comedians I know, you must be aware on some level that there is a lot of cynicism amongst comedians. People, there's bitterness. There's people have been maybe doing it too long or doing it without achieving the success they wanted. Do you have anything you could say to, I mean, I know personally some of them will be listening to this. Oh, do you have anything that you could say to help?
No, because they'll be like, shut up, that fucking dickhead.
No, they might not. They might not. They might, if they listen to it on their own, they might go, oh, go on. I'm thinking of a specific name who I'm certainly not going to name. But someone... I will tell you after. Someone might be listening to this and thinking, God, I wish I could... I've got really bitter. I've got really cynical. How can I get some of that?
Okay, I am not somebody who is without cynicism or bitterness or anxiety or status anxiety. Like, obviously not. Like you were saying, like, and the idea that you'd be like, oh, you know what you're doing, you've been all right. And then I'm like, well, I'm not, like, on telly. I'm not sort of successful. I'm not... So I think you can't help sometimes just be looking at yourself and thinking, what am I doing wrong? That person got that and I didn't, or that person did this and I didn't. But... there's two things. There's a quote by Bill Callahan, my favourite musician, which is, bitterness is our lowest sin and a bitter man rots from within. Like, it's no good for you. And I had a quote in my, had a line in my old show, which was, you have to just try not to be bitter, because no one ever says, guess who I'm bringing on the expedition? This bitter, shriveled up old husk. Like, nobody says that. No one's like, oh, they'll really bring down morale. Like, oh, they'll be great, you know. It's much better. Even if you have to fucking fake it, just try and be hopeful and try and, like, what I love about, especially with Edinburgh as well, is somebody who people have never rated can come along and do an amazing Edinburgh show, and people are like, have you seen their show? No, their show's incredible. Are you serious? Yeah, it's amazing. And, like, I see it as, like, this wellspring of, like, you can always kind of create some sort of narrative or interesting thing around yourself that means that people will want to come and see you. You can always, something will happen to you sooner or later that you'll be excited about to write about, that you'll think, this is something I really desperately want to say, and I think it's, you know, worth doing. And, like, I think as well, like, just if you can try and enjoy your life, honestly, people will want to be around you more. Like, no one wants to be around someone who's like, did you hear? That person got 2 stars and there's Steve Bennett said this. Like, fucking Steve Bennett. But, like, I don't like women. Sorry. Steve, if you're listening, I don't mean it. But I just genuinely, if you can try to, like, the more positive you are, the better your life will be and the better your comedy will be. And, like, I'm not saying fake it. I'm just saying be honest. Like, life is difficult sometimes. You don't get what you want all the time. All that shit is true. But also, like, fuck's sake, it's good. It's all right. Is that helpful to them? I'd also say, like, just don't look at what other people are doing. Like, don't, if you're in Edinburgh, don't read all the reviews, because the second you do that, you're like, oh no, what does that mean? Does that mean what? Like, focus on what you can control and you can enjoy and what you can create. Like, make up more gigs, do more silly things. Me and my friends did this thing that I always go on about, where we took a bus and we just performed to kids in bus shelters around the country. It was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. Like, if you do things, that's it. I'm going on too much.
No, go for it.
Stand up is great because it's an end in itself. It's not getting you telly. It's not getting you jobs. It's an end in itself. It's fucking brilliant on its own. If you like performing to 30 people in the room and you know you're going to do that till you die, you're all right, right? And that's the essence of being a stand-up to me, is like knowing that you're never going to escape little gigs, because that's what it is. And like, stand-up's a magic, ephemeral thing that is in the moment, right? So you don't need to like be thinking about other things. Just enjoy it as an end in itself. I'm like, fucking be as zen as me. It's fucking great.
Ladies and gentlemen, Josie Long. So that was Josie. Thanks to her for coming on the show. Thanks, as always, to James Lowy, Pete Jones and Olivia Phipps, who was the pod gremlin for this show. This episode was recorded live at Bob and Misbehave's bookshop under the Heroes of Fringe banner at Edinburgh 2014 and was co-produced by Nathan Wood. Now, if you're a comedian and you listen to this and you consider that, now look, in the past I've said if you've done about 3 shows, but I've got to underline this, that's kind of a minimum requirement unless I waive the rules. What we want from Comedian's Comedian is a glimpse into the process of an expert comic, right? So it's not just a case of doing the hours. If you're asking to be on the show, you're basically saying I consider myself an expert. Now, with that in mind, I know that some of you are experts and I particularly love guests who know the show. So if you're out there, drop me an email or a tweet using the code phrase. You remember the code phrase. I'd be pleased to be introduced to your beautiful daughter, and then I'll know that you're a process junkie and not just some kind of awful glory hound. What little glory there is I'm able to send your way, I don't know. Next week, the bloody brilliant Eleanor Tiernan. I've used brilliant again, but she totally deserves it. Bye for now. I'll speak to you then.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.